From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Joy Harjo, America's first Native American poet laureate. She's currently serving her third term. Her new memoir describes her story and her family history, including her family's story of the Trail of Tears. She is a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation and lives in Tulsa. When she was a child, the only book in her house was a Bible. The Native rights and Native arts movement of the 60s helped her find her direction in life, but it was a path she sometimes strayed from. Later, the story of how one cotton sack that was passed down from an enslaved woman to her young daughter who was about to be sold tells a larger story about slavery. We'll hear from historian Taya Miles, author of the new book, All That She Carried. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Joy Harjo, is the first Native American to be appointed Poet Laureate of the U.S., and she's only the second Poet Laureate to be appointed to a third term, the term she's now serving. Her new memoir, Poet Warrior, is a personal story, including how she learned to find herself in the spiritual world. It's also the story of how her family connects to the history of Native people in America. She writes about her great-grandfather, who survived the Trail of Tears, the government-enforced relocation to what was designated as Indian Territory. That's how her family wound up in Oklahoma. Harjo is a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation and lives in Tulsa. In addition to her own collections of poems, she edited the books When the Light of the World Was Subdued, Our Songs Came Through, a Norton anthology of Native Nations poetry, and Living Nations, Living Words, an anthology of First Peoples poetry. At the age of 40, Harjo started playing saxophone. She plays and recites her poems on her new album, I Pray for My Enemies. Joy Harjo, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I just want to start with a language question. I use the expression Native American. In your book, you say that you don't really like that expression, but I asked you about it beforehand, and you said you're kind of with it now. You're changing your mind. So tell us what words you like to use to describe your heritage and why you have that preference or those preferences.
Well, I grew up with the term Indians or American Indians, and of course, that's problematic too. And Native American came out of the academic realm somewhere in the 80s. And for me, I've settled on just Native with the capital N, or sometimes I use Indigenous or even, you know, First Peoples.
But you said it was okay to use Native American. Explain why you're okay with that.
It's become ubiquitous, and even the younger people are using that term. Although among ourselves, we call each other by our tribal nations' names.
It sounds from your memoir like a real turning point for you as a person and as a poet was the Native empowerment movement of the 60s. What were the issues that you were fighting for then?
The 60s, I equate a lot with, you know, civil rights. You know, it was a humanity alert that this country is huge. There's more of us and not everyone has equal rights. In the late 60s, I was at Indian boarding school in Santa Fe, New Mexico, not your usual boarding school, but it was an arts school. And I remember hearing about Martin Luther King being killed, and all of that was on the news. And we were all young Native artists there from eighth grade to 2 years postgraduate. We'd stay up late nights talking and making art together and talking about what it meant to be a Native person and about history and about how our art was part of history making.
And did you become an activist?
Yes, I think I always was in some way. You know, is that I think what I've come to realize and that what has motivated my art making is really a strong need for justice, for people to be treated, for everyone. And when I say people, I also mean animals and insects and the birds and the earth person that we are all part of, that there's a key element, and that's respect. And, you know, when I became more actively involved as a student at the University of New Mexico, I was painting then and just starting to write poetry. And I remember thinking, if my work does nothing else, when I get to the end of my life, I want Native peoples to be seen as human beings.
Were there specific issues related to sovereignty or equal rights that you were fighting for then?
I remember sitting as a young person, as a student, sitting in on meetings with coal companies, uranium companies in the Southwest, with Native peoples attempting to get a voice in or attempting to turn the story towards respect for the earth, the respect for the people, to take care of, you know, the quality of water, the quality of people's lives. And I remember at one point going out to do a story at just after the Church Rock uranium spill, and there were children out playing in the water and the livestock, and the Navajo speakers were saying, "What we need a word. I mean, how do we come up with a word that will tell the people that even though you can't see it, there is something dangerous here that can harm you and you can't use these waters, when it was the only source of water for their livestock.
I'd like you to read a poem that I think relates to what we're talking about. And it's in your new memoir, and it doesn't really have a title. It's just kind of integrated into the text. And the first line is, "Poet warrior reached for a gun."
Okay, here goes. Poet warrior reached for a gun. She was given a paintbrush, a saxophone, a pen. "These will be your instruments of power," the old one said. Though the gun gleamed and pranced as a tool of takeover by governments, even as it danced through the imaginations of revolutionaries as the perfect tool for social change. "Do not be fooled," they told her. "Violence might be louder, tougher, and is often good-looking. The power of insight and compassion is fiercely humble and helpful. Be ready for what the story of your age demands. You will be tested. There will be jealousy, envy, but the most difficult enemies will be from your closest circle, even your family. You must act in a manner that will cause no harm to anyone, seven generations back or forward."
That's my guest, Joy Harjo, reading a poem from her new memoir, Poet Warrior. So you've been a tribal member of the Muscogee tribe since birth. What does it mean to, like, officially be a tribal member?
Well, yeah, that becomes a very hot political subject because there are federally recognized tribal groups and tribal nations in this country. There are tribal nations that are legitimate that are not federally recognized. There are many fake tribal entities that are trying to claim tribal status for a number of reasons. So there's something certainly about belonging, and, you know, it's like any family. I think for me, let me just put it here, you know, I belong to a family, and this is my family.
I want to ask you about your great-grandfather, Manawi. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Yeah, Manawi. He's six generations great-grandfather.
Oh, so he's like great, 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 great.
Yeah, I have a great-grandfather, Henry Marcy Harjo, and then my sixth-generation grandfather, Manawi, who fought against Andrew Jackson.
And you describe him as one of the beloved leaders of our people. You say he and his warriors stood up against Andrew Jackson and the U.S. government against the illegal move from our homelands. So would you describe the removal and the law that made it mandatory?
What I can say is that, you know, he went against law. Andrew Jackson, President Andrew Jackson, went against Congress to remove Southeastern Native peoples from the lands there into Indian Territory, or what became known as Oklahoma. Of course, we did not go willingly. There were several scuffles and fights and even massacres against this illegal removal. But we were force marched from our homelands. And I think a lot of America thinks, well, they think it's only there was only the Cherokee or the so-called five civilized tribes that included the Muscogee Creek. But these kind of removals or forced migrational marches happened all over the country. And we were moved because people wanted those lands. They were very rich, the Southeast, very rich in resources and water and animals and plants and so on. But we lost probably at least half of our peoples on that march due to hardship, freezing, violence, rape, all kinds of things that happened on those different removal marches. I think a lot of America, when they think back in history and see natives, we were hiding out in the woods, wearing rags and so on. But, you know, we had huge societies. I have a great, great, great uncle who had the largest horse racing establishment on the eastern seaboard, Muscogee Creek man, and half Irish. And they wanted that. You know, they wanted what we had.
Let me reintroduce you here. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joy Harjo, America's Poet Laureate. Her new memoir is called Poet Warrior. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Joy Harjo, the first Native American to serve as Poet Laureate. She's now serving her third term. Her new memoir is called Poet Warrior. We talked a little bit about one of your great-great-great-great-grandfathers. Your great-grandfather, Henry Marcy Harjo, was somebody who's been very important in your life, even though I don't think you ever met him. I think he died before you were born. He ended up having oil money, and this is a really interesting story that also has to do with Native history. So do you want to explain in the simplest terms how he ended up living on oil-rich land and getting a lot of money as a result?
Yeah, it's a story that happened to a lot of indigenous peoples who were force-moved from their homelands as they would put people on lands they figured no one else wanted or didn't consider that maybe even other people lived there. But they would put us on lands that no one else wanted, and then lo and behold, somebody would discover uranium or oil or coal or gas. And so what happened after we were removed to Oklahoma and had settled in communities, because we had it wasn't really ownership, communal use of lands, the Allotment Act, the Dawes Act, was put into place, and so the U.S. government started dividing up the land, which meant enrolling people and dividing up the land and giving people parcels of land. Well, one of those parcels that belonged to my great grandfather and my great grandmother in the family was near Glenpool. I think it was in Kiefer, a little community called Kiefer, Oklahoma. And that was one of the largest oil fields that in the country. I think it was the largest oil fields. It was so huge that there were Glenpool, the town is still there, Glenpool, was basically a lake of oil.
So did your great-grandfather keep the oil rights or sell it to an oil company? How did he make the money?
Well, they were, you know, he had rights. They were getting pretty big checks, I take it. You know, it was, they went on trips. He had the first car in Okmulgee, Oklahoma. And so they did fairly well. But it's a story I've always wanted to research because it made me wonder how much natives were getting per barrel of oil versus non-native people. And just like the story that was told in Killers of the Flower Moon, a lot of tribal citizens were killed, or people would marry different citizens for the oil. And there were all kinds of shenanigans going on to steal, including killing off parents, becoming guardians of the surviving children, and getting into the riches that way. So there's a lot of stories. Well, he wound up, I don't know exactly what happened. I know my father would get oil royalties, and then when he passed, we got oil royalties, but by the time they came to, his share came down to four children, the oil boom and, you know, a lot of it was gone. So we would get really small checks. And then one day I got a letter from the oil company saying that our rights had been sold. And they produced a document that appeared that my father had sold off his mineral rights. But I'm not sure that that really happened. You know, I don't know. It's a story. So now we don't have them. And it's a story I've always wanted to investigate because I'm not sure that's my father's signature. I have a lot of questions about what happened and what happened to the other shares.
By the time it happened, you could no longer ask your father.
Right.
Native tradition is an oral tradition, not a written tradition. How did you become absorbed in books and poems and language? And did you have people to share that love with?
I've been trying to think of the first time I encountered reading or books, because the only book we had in our house, I think, was the Bible. And I like the pictures. You know, often there were pictures in those books, or at least the one we had. And when I went to first grade, when we started to learn how to read, I was so thrilled about what happened with symbols, and that suddenly it opened up a world to me. I could read. I read all of the books in the first grade classroom and was sent into the second grade. And it became like a hunger for me. But I like the sounds, of course. I like the sound that words make. I like the percussion, the percussive elements, and the images and so on. Just like, you know, I the same kind of thing I heard in my mother's song making. But the more I read and the more the ability grew, the deeper I could read, the more stories. And I could be transported in much the same way that I could be in that kind of visionary dream world when I was younger. And when we get to about 7, and I think this happens to a lot of us, we forsake those realms of knowing and understanding, and reading helped give that back.
Your mother wrote some songs, words and music?
Yes, she did. She wrote, when I was really young, she was still with my father, she was writing songs. So she was so in love with him. And they were ballads, and a lot of them were very sad, but they were so beautiful. And she was going in and recording demos. And the band leader, a very famous band leader here, Ernie Fields, took one of her songs and arranged it into a orchestral piece. But she loved music. And she had an old Underwood typewriter that was the most intriguing thing in the house that we were supposed to stay away from. But it was, you know, it could make words. And that all stopped when they divorced. But there was a moment when we were immersed in music in our home.
You write that you were hungry for ritual, I guess when you were growing up and became a young woman, and you kind of created an imaginary ritual for yourself. I think one of the problems that you had when you were going from that transition between adolescence and adulthood was that, you know, in going through puberty, you felt like there was no one to protect you from being preyed on by men and young men. Your father and your stepfather were abusive men, so you weren't going to rely on them to protect you. They were part of the problem. Is that part of the reason why you tried to draw on the presence, the, I guess, spiritual presence of, like, your great-grandfathers?
Yes, I think that there is always, I don't believe that we come into this world alone. We have assistance. And we have assistance from, I guess, what people call the other side. But they, you know, there's interaction that goes on. I've learned this, especially being an artist, of a writer, a musician, that, you know, there's resonances. You can call it resonances. But yes, I have always felt this, my great-grandfather, Henry Marcy Harjo, around me, exactly when I needed him or his wisdom. And I think it's true for everyone. I have been at the births of several of my grandchildren, and someone always walks them in. So that when I was writing this memoir, and I had a dream towards the end of writing it, and in the dream, I was carrying my 7th generation granddaughter into the world. And it's a ritual. It's a ritual we all do, you know, where you open the blanket and you look at them and you admire them and you look at who's coming in and you welcome them, and sometimes you can see their gifts and what they're bringing, and you give them a blessing. And so in the dream, I was holding my 7th generation granddaughter, and I said, "Whoa, you look like your grandmother Rainey, and you look Japanese." And in my mind, I'm thinking, I wonder what happened in the story. And so seven generations. And I walked her. I carried her into her story as she was being born. And I believe that it really, I believe it was one of those dreams that I know that it happened, it is happening, or it will happen.
Your dreams are very important to you. And from what I've read, it sounds like you keep several journals, and one of them is strictly devoted to dreams. Do dreams have a special significance among Muscogee?
I think so. I mean, dreams are, I know for myself, I'll just speak for myself, is that they have been, I could even say companions. It's almost like writing or what you go into, the kind of space you go into when you create, you know, whether it's poetry or music or even writing memoirs, you go into this space. Some dreams are, whoa, I ate too much pizza, or, you know, I got to work something out here and it's going to work out through, you know, this, that, or the other in the dream. But other dreams are like the dream of carrying my granddaughter. I will always remember that because I was just as present and alive there as I am speaking to you right now. And I've had several dreams that have marked major turning points or perceptual events that have helped me along the way.
Let's take a break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Joy Harjo, America's Poet Laureate, and her new memoir is called Poet Warrior. We'll be back after we take a short break. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, a hiring platform with tools like Instant Match, which searches millions of resumes in Indeed's database to connect businesses with candidates that match the sponsored job description. More at Indeed.com/credit. And from FX, presenting Impeachment, American Crime Story, a limited series about the events that led to the first impeachment of a U.S. president in more than a century. Impeachment, American Crime Story, premieres tonight at 10 p.m. on FX.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with Joy Harjo, the first Native American to serve as Poet Laureate of the U.S. She's currently serving her third term. She's a member of the Muscogee Creek Nation and lives in Tulsa. Her new memoir is called Poet Warrior. She also has a new CD called I Pray for My Enemies, in which she reads her poems with music accompaniment and plays saxophone, an instrument she first picked up when she was 40. You grew up in violent homes. Your father was abusive to you and your mother. He was also very attractive and charismatic and seemed to know it and cheated on your mother. Then you had a white stepfather who was maybe even more abusive. He forced your mother to play Russian roulette while your younger siblings watched. You weren't there at the time. You know, after growing up in a violent home, you wrote, I made the decision that I would be different. I would make my own life free of marriage, of violence, and the dominance of the belief system that demands that women must have a husband and children to be happy. I hadn't seen that happiness at home or in many of the homes around me. So you had this will to break away and to be different, to be independent, to not depend on a man or children to be happy. But you had a child when you were 17. So what did you do when you were 17 and pregnant, and then we were still 17 when you gave birth, or 18. I'm not sure if there's a big difference one way or the other. Yeah, so were you still in school?
No, I graduated from high school a year early because I had enough credits from the Institute of American Indian Arts, and I had just been in one of the first all-Native drama and dance troupes, and we performed in some big theaters in the Pacific Northwest and different Native communities, and I came back pregnant, no one knew, and then got on a bus and showed up to the bait where the baby's father lived, and he miraculously met the bus, and I lived with some friends of his on a couch, and then lived with him and his mother and his grandmother. And I didn't know how I was going to get through that or get out of it, because I had no means, I had no escape route, really, and I was just trying to make the best of it.
How did you get out of that?
We moved out of Oklahoma, moved back to New Mexico.
We being who? You?
My son's father, my then husband, and my son and his daughter, my stepdaughter. We moved back to New Mexico, and there I was again in that circle of other Native artists. And that lifted my spirits because I had community there.
I'm sure a lot of people were telling you, that's all very nice, but you have to make some money and you're not going to be able to support your children by making beautiful things or writing poetry.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, well, the art that people could understand, you know, there's artists. I come from a family, my aunt, my grandmother, Naomi Harjo, Aunt Lois Harjo, they were artists. They made paintings, oil paintings, they made real art. And in Oklahoma growing up, a lot of Native artists all around. But when I went to poetry as undergrad at the University of New Mexico, when I went to poetry as my major, I got no encouragement except from the poetry teachers, you know, that I was a good poet, but nobody would support, nobody wanted to support poetry, and people were concerned. Because, you know, how are you going to make a living? And there was a push at that time. We had a tremendous push for Native peoples to gain degrees in law, in medicine, in the medical fields, in education, in economics, because there was a great need. There's, you know, a great need of people to fulfill those roles. But what role does a poet have?
You considered becoming a doctor. You went to med school and dropped out pretty quickly because you didn't feel prepared for all the heavy-duty science.
Right. I was pre-med when I entered the University of New Mexico with a minor in dance. But so there you go.
You are serving your third term now as Poet Laureate of the United States. Were there any clues along the way that something like that would happen to you?
I didn't know exactly where it was going to lead, but I knew it was the direction in which I needed to go. And along the way, there were years that there was no recognition, that what I published or did didn't seem to make a difference, but I followed because it made the path kept opening and opening and opening. And so to become the U.S. Poet Laureate is quite an honor. But I had no idea. I had no idea that it would come to that.
I want to turn the subject to music and poetry. You started playing saxophone when you were 40, which, you know, is considered like really late to start to learn an instrument. Did you make your peace when you started playing saxophone, knowing that things wouldn't be as kind of automatic for you as for people who learned as children, where, like, you know, like the chords and the keys, it just becomes second nature because you're learning it when your brain is being formed?
Yes, it was, you know, I played clarinet a couple of years when I was younger.
Oh, so you had some of the basics.
I had some basics, and we were lucky that we had music. We had music and art in elementary school. here in Tulsa, at least, you know, in those years. So I had some music background. I walked away from music because around the same time I stopped singing because one, the band teacher wouldn't let girls play saxophone, so I left band. And around the same time, my stepfather would not allow me to sing in the house. And
why?
He didn't want, you know, because I think it represented happiness. And I did it in my room, closed door, listening to Columbia House Records that I subscribed to. But, you know, it represented, my mother didn't sing. You know, my mother was a singer and songwriter, and she wasn't allowed to sing either. Nor did she feel like singing. It was almost as if he had locked up all the, you know, a bird family in a house and forbid us to sing.
That is so sad.
So I left it all behind, and it wasn't until I was almost 40 that I got a band together, and I started fooling around on a saxophone. I learned the G blues scale and slowly started playing and got an all-native band together, mostly native musicians who were also attorneys. And we started the Poetic Justice. That's the name. We started a band called Joy Harjo and Poetic Justice, and that was the beginning of it.
Well, I want to close with a track from the album, and I want to play you reading your poem, Fear, with music accompaniment. I'd like you to introduce it for us and tell us about writing the poem and what inspired it.
Yeah, the Fear song came about when I was first learning to write poetry as a student at the University of New Mexico. I had discovered poetry readings and native poets, and that's what opened the door to actually me taking up a pen or getting a typewriter then and writing my own poetry. And what I've learned about poetry is that, yes, I bring skills to it, but it's all about listening. And so I would listen and write, and then, of course, rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. But this poem came, I feel like this poem was larger than me, and it came to me to be helpful, and it's gone out into the world and been helpful to many people. And I have recorded it before, and I wasn't going to record it again, but it seemed like in the middle of a pandemic, in the middle of such politically divisive times in this country and on the edge of, you know, ecological disaster, that we needed that this poem song might be useful again. So that's why I decided to add it to this album.
So the poem is Fear, and we're going to hear it from Joy Harjo's album, I Pray for My Enemies. Joy Harjo, thank you so much for talking with us, and stay well.
Yeah, well, thank you so much.
I release you, my beautiful and terrible fear. I release you. You were my beloved and hated twin, but now I don't know you as myself. I release you with all the pain I would know at the death of my children. You are not my blood anymore. I give you back to the soldiers who burned down my home, beheaded my children. I give you back to those who stole the food from our plates when we were starving. I release you, fear, because you hold these scenes in front of me, and I was born with eyes that can never close. I release you, I release you, I release you, I release you. I am not afraid to be angry. I am not afraid to rejoice. I am not afraid to be black. I am not afraid to be white. I am not afraid to be hungry. I am not afraid to be full. I am not afraid to be hated. I am not afraid to be loved. To be loved. To be loved. To be loved. Fear.
Joy Harjo's new memoir is called Poet Warrior. After we take a short break, the story of one cotton bag that survived being handed down from an enslaved woman to her young daughter, who was about to be sold. We'll hear from historian Taya Miles, author of All That She Carried. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Union of Concerned Scientists, championing science for a healthy planet and safer world. Learn more at ucsusa.org. And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for small and medium-sized businesses with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and mobility features to run their businesses from anywhere. More at ooma.com.
This is Fresh Air. Our guest interviewer, Arun Venugopal, has the next interview. He's a host and senior producer at public radio station WNYC in New York. Here's Arun.
One winter day in South Carolina in the 1850s, an enslaved woman by the name of Rose discovered that her 9-year-old daughter was about to be sold off and that they'd in all likelihood be separated for the rest of their lives. So Rose made a quick decision, packing a cotton bag with a few personal items and little food and placing it in her daughter's hands. That cotton bag remained in the child's possession and was passed on from one generation to the next, and at one point in the early 1900s was inscribed with the family's tale. And this journey of an embroidered cotton bag from the days of slavery to its eventual place in the National Museum of African American History and Culture is at the center of a new book, All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley Sack, a Black Family Keepsake. In the words of author Taya Miles, this book is about the burdens of being human in an inhumane world, and about how Black women in particular have responded to systemic erasure with art, compassion, and love. The history of Africans in America is brutal, she writes, but we have made art out of pain, sustaining our spirits with sunbursts of beauty, teaching ourselves how to rise the next day. Miles is a historian at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University, and is also the author of The Dawn of Detroit and Tales from the Haunted South. Taya Miles, welcome to Fresh Air. You've brought us from the 1850s when Rose, the mother of Ashley, in sort of an act of desperation, but also, as you describe, an act of love, hands her this bag, and she's sold off at the age of 9. And then decades later, her own granddaughter, Ashley's granddaughter, Ruth Middleton, decides to inscribe this tale upon the cloth to embroider in a few sentences the story of her family. What is it that she tells us in this inscription?
So this is what Ruth has sewn onto the sack. My great-grandmother Rose, mother of Ashley, gave her this sack when she was sold at age 9 in South Carolina. It held a tattered dress, 3 handfuls of pecans, a braid of Rose's hair. Told her it'd be filled with my love always. She never saw her again. Ashley is my grandmother, Ruth Middleton, 1921. So in this inscription, Ruth Middleton tells us those specific names and events and locations and emotions that really encapsulate her family's story of brutal separation during enslavement. Ruth Middleton has made a choice to sew this family record, to sew this story, rather than to write it down on a piece of paper, for example. And I think that decision of hers is actually information about her, information about what it meant to be a young Black woman in Philadelphia in the early 1900s, and what the value of handicrafts and especially fancy sewing work was to Black women who had for their entire lives and for many generations in this country been relegated to a lower category of womanhood, a category of womanhood that was viewed as being fit for brute manual labor, as opposed to being fit for the kinds of feats of artistry that Ruth Middleton is reaching for when she decides to embroider her family story.
You mentioned that that there's hair, that a little lock of hair, and you mentioned pecans as well, which might have just seemed like, oh, here's something to eat on the way. But you write in the book that something even as simple as pecans is not something that Rose would have easily come by, that it was actually quite rare for someone in her position to have come into possession of. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, that is right. You brought up the hair and you brought up the pecans in particular. Those are not just simple things. Rose actually cut off one of her own braids and packed it for her daughter, Ashley. This was such an incredible action, I think, of self-worth and self-possession and of communication. Because Rose, of course, didn't own herself legally. She was owned by a white South Carolinian couple legally. And so her hair was technically not her own. And yet through this act of taking a part of her body, which didn't belong to her legally, and packing it away for her daughter, Rose silently stated self-possession, self-worth. And I think that she passed that message on to her daughter through giving her that braid. By giving this braid to Ashley, Rose was making sure that she would physically be present with Ashley into the future.
At some point in the life of this bag, it was no longer in the possession of Rose and Ashley's descendants, and it was rediscovered in the 21st century by a flea market shopper, a white woman who was rummaging through a bunch of old stuff. Where exactly did she find it?
She found it in Tennessee. She was a woman who used her garage sailing and flea marketing afternoons and weekends to supplement her family's income. She would find interesting things, and then sometimes she would resell them on eBay to help pay for her kids' tuition, actually. And she came across this bin of rags in a Tennessee flea market, just rifling through the bin, and noticed the inscription on the sack. She read it and recognized that this was something special. She then went and purchased the whole bin of old discarded cloth, of rags, for $20, and then started to research the names on the sack.
And when the bag first went on display, this was at Middleton Place, correct? A museum that was once a plantation. I'm just wondering, how do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, that's the question, right? I felt that it was in some ways a betrayal of everything that Rose had attempted to accomplish and everything that Ashley had attempted and Rosa, Ashley's daughter, had attempted and Ruth had attempted when Ruth finally actually moved to the North. I mean, Ruth had gotten out. She had gotten out of South Carolina. She had gotten out of this place that had enslaved generations of her foremothers. She had gone north, like thousands of other African Americans, in this first wave of the Great Migration. And yet, this object that she clearly cherished and that she devoted her time and her artistry to transforming was sent right back down to the very state where her foremothers were separated from one another and where they suffered this terrible loss. So I did feel all of that when I went to Middleton Place. I felt a sense of sadness and a sense of resentment for these women. And yet, when I sat with not only the feelings, but also with the complexity of the situation, I came to realize that this was the way that this sack had been rescued, in a sense. Middleton Place was the institution that acquired the sack and that devoted its own people power to, you know, researching the sack and to curating it for the very first time, to trying to understand who the women were. And so my feeling of it is that, yes, we wish that Ruth's descendants had been able to continue to steward this sack. Or we might wish that a Black managed and a Black owned historic site or museum or institution actually owned the sack. Yet that's not what happened. Middleton Place Foundation is the owner of the sack, and the staff members there are caring for it, and they view it as their most important artifact.
We're listening to the interview our guest interviewer, Arun Venugopal, recorded with historian Taya Miles, author of the new book, All That She Carried. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to the interview our guest interviewer Arun Venugopal recorded with historian Taya Miles, author of the new book, All That She Carried. It's about what we can learn from slavery and survival from one cotton bag that was passed on from an enslaved woman in the 1850s to her 9-year-old daughter who was about to be sold.
You found your own family story tethered, as you say, to that of Rose and Ashley, in part because of something that happened to your ancestors during Jim Crow, a story that was often recounted to you by your grandmother Alice. What is it that she kept on telling you over the years?
Well, my grandmother was one of these women who was a natural-born storyteller. And one of the stories that she continually returned to was the event of the loss of her family's farm in rural Mississippi. And what happened is that she and her family were doing well. They had livestock. They had, as she puts it, plenty to eat, which was always very important to her. And they, I think, expected life to go on in this way, to go on in a way that they had some degree of protection from the worst that the South could hand Black people. But it didn't happen that way. Instead, there were some white men in this Mississippi town who came to her family's farm and who demanded that her father, who had actually lived quite a long life, had married a woman who was much younger than he and who had been enslaved as a child. They asked her father to sign a document, which he couldn't read because he had not had the opportunity to be educated. And then they came back, these white men, with guns, saying that the document that he had signed, his name was Price, my great-grandfather, basically gave over his farm and his wife's livestock, because she owned the cows, to them. And because they were white men and because they had guns and because it was the early 1900s in Mississippi, many decades before the Civil Rights Movement, a terribly unsafe place, the family had to move, and they had to move right then. And my grandmother talked about how her big sister, Margaret, was able to save one cow and take it over to the neighbor's house for safekeeping. And even though they were quite poor after the loss of their farm, the memory of her sister, Margaret, saving that cow had always stuck with her, and she passed it along to me.
And you actually inherited a quilt from this same great aunt, Margaret, didn't you?
Yes, I have a quilt that she made, and it's on my wall right now. I'm just turning to look at it. It's a quilt that my grandmother cherished because, of course, it reminded her of Margaret. And so for me, this quilt represents that resistance, that resilience, that creative action in the face of pressure, and that insistence on carrying on despite trauma.
Taya Miles, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Arun.
Taya Miles is a professor of history at the Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study at Harvard University and author of the new book, All That She Carried. She spoke with guest interviewer Arun Venugopal, a host and senior producer at public radio station WNYC in New York. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, we'll remember actor Michael K. Williams. We'll listen back to two interviews with him. He co-starred in The Wire, Boardwalk Empire, The Night Of, and When They See Us. He's nominated for an Emmy for his performance in Lovecraft Country. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Denny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering today from Adam Staniszewski. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Chaloner, Seth Kelly, Kayla Lattimore, and Joel Wolfram. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from Subaru, with the 2021 Subaru Forester, featuring standard symmetrical all-wheel drive and safety technology. Love, it's what makes Subaru, Subaru. Learn more at Subaru.com.